And they make
little help.
I only know one person did that, but he's now a chasid of Rosh Yeshiva, so he probably knew what he was talking about. But in order not to be chayiv in tzitzis. But all you have to do, by the way, all you have to do is make a slight cut on one corner. You don't have to do a major thing on everything. A little cut on one corner would be enough to exempt it from tzitzis.
Oh, really?
Yes, yes.
So you can deliberately just make a cut?
Sure, that's what you should do.
Okay.
Little cut.
It's like those plastic, you know, ring.
Right. You're one of those things. Right. Okay, let me explain what the mitzvah of tzitzis is. The mitzvah of tzitzis says, it's really in more of a negative than a positive. You are not allowed to wear a fork, or at least this is for men, women don't have the mitzvah, but a man is not allowed to wear a four square cornered garment unless it has fringes attached. Now, if a man doesn't want to wear a four cornered square garment, as far as the Torah is concerned, that's perfectly fine. In other words, I don't have to put on tzitzis every day, except during davening or the like. However, if I wear a four-cornered garment, I must have the fringes on top. So there is no sin if somebody would not put on their tzitzis. There is no sin involved, because if they're not wearing the requisite four corners, they don't have fringes. However, it is said that as a matter of reminder, since we should be reminded of Hashem's mitzvos, it is a meritorious, righteous practice for men to put on tzitzis every day, and children do it because of chinuch. But, see, if someone is not wearing tzitzis, there is no avera that is being committed. Because the mitzvah of tzitzis is only if you're wearing... See, ironically, this is interesting. If you're wearing a four-cornered garment, and the tzitzis are pasul, that's an avera, because you're wearing a four-cornered garment without tzitzis. If you don't wear the garment at all, that's technically not an avera. It's like shechita. A lot of mitzvahs are that way. If you want to eat meat, you have to be sure that the meat is slaughtered, but you're not obligated every day to get up and say, I'm going to slaughter my animal today. Get, right? If one is divorcing his wife, there's a mitzvah to do it a certain way, but there's no mitzvah to go out and, you know, divorce your wife. Right? So tzitzis is not an obligatory mitzvah in the sense that tefillin is. Tefillin, a man is obligated to put on tefillin every day. Tzitzis, it is only if you're wearing a garment, you must be sure that there are the fringes on it. And you don't have to put fringes on garments that are in your drawer. I mean, you know, because you don't have to look for four-cornered garments and put on tzitzis. Tzitzis is a chiyuv on those things that you wear. Yeah.
Well, when the children go in summer to camp, for example, should they wear a t-shirt underneath their tzitzis, or they can put it directly?
Me'ikar hadin, according to the strict halacha, we don't really care. The talus katan can be directly against the flesh, but it's not proper for the tzitzis to do so. In other words, you're more concerned for the fringes and not the garment. So it happens to be, if you're not wearing a t-shirt, very often the tzitzis themselves, unless the tzitzis are out, are going to be against the bare skin, and that you try to avoid. But the concern is not for the... remember, as far as halacha is concerned, the talus katan is essentially just an undershirt anyway. And it's allowed to be. Because remember, you put tzitzis on your clothing, so it can be your clothing. There's nothing wrong with it being your clothing. No. What you do is you should you can put them in plastic, and then you could throw them in the garbage. But you should put them in plastic because they shouldn't intermingle with the garbage.
Cut off the fringes to put into the garbage, or the whole baguette?
You can do whatever you want. In other words, if you want to reuse the baguette and have new tzitzis attached, you can do that. You don't have to throw out the whole baguette. You can have a choice.
Is there kedusha for the baguette?
No, the baguette is no kedusha. The baguette is an article of clothing. Remember, in the time, I mean, originally tzitzis were put on your suits and on your robes and on your, this is clothing. So the talus katan does not have kedusha, but the tzitzis have a certain element of kedusha that you put.
But a real talus has kedusha to it?
Well, not really. A real talus is really treated as just a garment that you wear for tefillah. It's like a special garment that we wear during davening.
But the tzitzis of the talus have kedusha?
Have some kedusha, yeah. But even then, you don't have to put it in shemus. You can put it in the garbage, but you put it in plastic. Tzitzis are like a lulav and esrei. They are. You have to treat them with some respect.
But you have to take them to shul when they're
shamed. No, you don't. You don't. If you have a mezuzah, tefillin, that you have to put in shamus. Sefer Torah, Svarim, Siddur, but things like the tzitzis, things like lulav and esrog, you wrap them in plastic and then you can discard them.
Is that true that you are not allowed to fold your talis on Shabbos?
There are different customs, but it is proper that it's not just a talis, by the way, no clothing should be folded on a crease on Shabbos. This would include pants or anything else, because folding something on a crease evens it out, and that's considered to be a form of improving garments on Shabbos. That's forbidden. So either you don't fold it or you fold it not on its standardized creases. Yeah.
Rabbi,
Well,
you're talking square garment.
Yeah.
Are you talking rectangle and square?
Yeah, rectangle is also, yeah. I mean,
so
it's
the corners.
It meets, the corners meet at right angles. That's what I mean. Yeah, it could be rectangle, yeah.
Could I ask a different question that came up?
Yeah, I do want to get back to Korach, but okay. No, please. Okay.
I was confused in terms of telling my child what to do yesterday. She was in the brachos leading right up to Shema.
Right.
And they were saying Kedusha.
Yeah.
Does she, do you stop to say Kedusha, or do you, and say Kedusha, or do you just stop while they say Kedusha, or?
Okay, when you are in the middle of Shema, or the blessings, before and after the Shema, you actually stop and you answer Kedusha, but you don't say everything. You answer the three, right? Kedusha is really three primary verses that are interspersed with other things. The three primary verses are Kadosh, 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 and then Baruch Kvod Hashem Nimkamo, and Yimloch Hashem Le'olam Alukayach Tzion. So she should be silent and answer to those three things. She should say those three things.
Now, that's it. At the end of you have to get to the end of a pasuk or at the end of a sentence in the verse?
Well,
or you
try...
Parakim?
No, even in the middle of a parak, you try to finish the sentence.
Just, and then you just stop and
even
you answer
those three things. Even B'emtzah HaPerek, you answer those three things.
But not Shema Yisrael. You don't say Shema Yisrael?
No, that you wouldn't say. Mm-hmm. Unless you're up to Shema Yisrael. But that would depend. If you're between the chapters, that depends. If you're between the Brachim, you would say the whole Kedusha, the whole thing.
Uh-huh.
And if you're B'emtzah HaPerek, you would answer those three things. Okay, but anyway, I just want to go back to the idea of Techeles. So the Techeles is a very profound symbolism, because the Techeles reminds us of our journey to Hashem, but the Lavan reminds us that we haven't completed that particular journey. And let me tell you another vort from the Sfas Emes, which is a very, very beautiful vort. He talks about these three stages. First you look at the ocean, then you look at the sky, and then you look at the cloud of glory. He says that this corresponds to the three miracles. Did I say this last week? Okay, I'm sorry. I've been speaking in different places.
Very nice.
Okay. Let me say it quickly. Okay. I really am sometimes losing the sense of what I said where. But he says that this. He says the following. He says that the ocean represents Yetzias Mitzrayim, which culminated in the splitting of the Red Sea. So the ocean reminds us of Hashem taking us out of Mitzrayim. And he says the sky reminds us of the Torah, which came from Shemayim. And the throne of glory reminds us of the clouds of glory, the Shekhinah that surrounds us. And we think of these three miracles whenever we look at the Techeles. And those three miracles are also connected to Moshe, Aaron, and Miriam. Because Moshe Rabbeinu, Miriam was the one who brought us the well of water, and Moshe brought us the man from Shemayim, and Aaron brought us the clouds of glory that surround us, right? So all of these things are connected. We think of Moshe, Aaron, and Miriam. It's even connected to the three regalim, Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkos. Pesach was Yetzias Mitzrayim, Shavuos was Matan Torah, and Sukkos are the clouds of glory that surround us. So all of that is implicit in looking at the Techeles, and ultimately the Sfas Emes says this corresponds to the three missions that a human being has in life. That is, one is to purify ourselves from the evil within us. That's Yetzias Mitzrayim, getting rid of the Egypt that is within us. And the second is to fill ourselves with Kedusha, that is Matan Torah, receiving Hashem's Torah. And the third is to try to improve the world, to have clouds of glory, bring the Shekhinah into the world, make a tikkun. and that is the clouds of glory that surround us. In other words, repair ourselves from the negative, absorb positive, and then influence the world around us. And that is the notion of making Hashem a presence in this world, that Hashem should have a throne in this world. You know, there's an amazing Gemara that talks about how jealousy can destroy us from concentrating on this mission. There's an amazing statement about Yeravam ben Nevat. Yeravam ben Nevat was the first king of the 10 tribes. And he was a Rasha. He made a golden calf in Beis El so people wouldn't go to Yerushalayim. And at one point, the Gemara recounts that Hashem appeared to him in prophecy and said, Yeravam, why don't you just do tshuva? And you and I and David ben Yishai will walk together in the Gan Eden. We'll be together. A pretty good offer. We'll be together, you and I, we'll be so close. So Yeravam's only question is, who's going to be first? And Hashem said, well, David will be first. He says, I don't want the deal. He says, you know, so me Barosh, so you see that how amazing, you know, we can be, how our judgment can be distorted and destroyed based on that particular point. Okay, I do have to leave a little early. What time do you have?
11:05.
Okay. 5 after 11. Maybe we'll step up. Now, next week I do have a chasna. I made a mistake. I announced last week about this week, which was an error. But next week I do have a chasna, so we will have the meeting next week.
Thank you.
Okay, have a good week.
Thank you.
Thank you for letting me make
tapes.
It's very nice of you, because it's very helpful to review some of the things you say.
If it'd be possible, I'd like to get copies of those.
Well, I didn't take the whole thing today. Okay. A lot of conversations.
Oh, you shut it? Okay.
It's for you.
Can I ask you a question?
All right, how are you?
Good.
I didn't see you yesterday.
Hi, Zillian. I didn't see you yesterday. You know, after we don't cover the
house,
but I was saying, but
good.
She said
anyway.
That you should leave the house covered.
Not yet, as soon as I do, I'll let you know. I don't see anybody coming up to ask yet.
Yeah, there are two customs. See, there are two reasons why we cover chala, and this would depend on the two practices. One reason we cover the chala is we don't want to embarrass the chala when we make kiddush over the wine. Now, according to that reason, you're correct. When you make hamotzi, you uncover the chala. That's correct. So you're following that reason. But the other reason that is given is that the man is covered with dew on top and at the bottom. So according to that reason, it should be covered when you make the bracha as well. So there are two customs.
So the thing is,
either way is right.
For years and years, I've uncovered. So should I maybe just continue?
Of depression. We know people who had wonderful childhoods who've become depressed. We know people who've had horrific childhoods who have never become depressed. Just the process of going back over all this old material and ruminating about it again and again may actually serve to perpetuate the depression rather than help the depression to lift.
Lissa Falk is a 47-year-old high school guidance counselor who had untreated clinical depression for more than 30 years. She describes why 6 years of talk therapy didn't lift her severe depression.
When I was in the middle of a depression, it was pointless to try and be problem solving. I could barely get out of bed. The hardest decision of the day that I had to make was what to wear to work. So to try and work on life problems in therapy in the middle of a depression was at best terribly inefficient and at the least impossible.
Again, Dr. Raymond DiPaolo.
Life events may well trigger depressions, but at the time somebody's severely depressed, we don't spend our initial energies trying to figure out which life event tripped off this depression. What we spend our time trying to do is getting the patient functional again, just like with an asthma patient in the emergency room. Who could care whether the asthma attack was set off by dust or by an allergy exposure? We've got to give the patient epinephrine and so they can breathe again. Well, the same thing is true in depression.
In the absence of proper medical care, people with clinical depression often look for other ways to relieve the pain. Again, Deidre Oakley.
When you feel like that, all you want is it to stop. You're so desperate at that point, it doesn't matter how you stop it. I mean, I would go out and I'd run like 15 miles trying to exhaust myself
thinking that that would calm me down, and it wouldn't do anything. I took a transcendental meditation class over a weekend, thinking that would help. And it would help a little bit, but it still didn't help a lot. Tried to get hypnotized. I tried acupuncture. I mean, you name it, I tried it.
In the interim, I just kept reading about it. Any article, anything that had to do with depression or stress or how to build your self-esteem, how to be your own best friend, you know, I would read that book. They didn't help. I read them and I understood that there was something seriously wrong, and I knew that it wasn't a character flaw. There was just something going on that was keeping me depressed.
I also started drinking a lot of wine. It calmed me down for a while, and so I'd have a couple hours of feeling almost normal. Can't say it made me happy, but at least it relieved me. It gave me a breather from this constant, agitated, foreboding sort of state I was in.
The National Institute of Mental Health estimates that 27% of people with clinical depression abuse alcohol or other substances. Again, Dr. Frederick K. Goodwin.
What she described very poignantly was a very, very common problem, that in order to escape this desperate pain, people turn to alcohol. The story of trying anything to escape from the foreboding is sort of like a pain of the very soul. And so one starts out with one problem, depression, then they get into drinking too much as a self-medication, and then the drinking takes on a life of its own.
Consider the case of Irene Wozni, a 39-year-old corporate attorney for the state of Maryland.
I wanted some relief from the symptoms. I wanted some relief from everything that was rolling around in my head constantly. It got to the point where I was drinking very heavily, very regularly. I drank so much that I got alcohol-induced hepatitis. I just didn't want to feel anything. I didn't want to think anything. I wanted to be out of it. And I guess I really didn't recognize that the fact that I developed alcoholism had really something to do with my affective disorder that wasn't being treated properly.
Living with clinical depression is painful. The difficulty can be compounded by family and friends who don't understand. Giovanni Gasparotto.
As far as friends and family are concerned, in the beginning, they try to be helpful, and when that doesn't work, they get this feeling of helplessness, and they say, why is this person so lazy? Why do they take so many days off from work? Why are they drinking so much? They just sit there and they just don't seem to care. It doesn't occur to them that it is truly an illness that can be treated and corrected. They just think it's bad behavior.
The effect on Giovanni's marriage was devastating.
My wife's response was, snap out of it and, you know, do something. I can't stand to have you just sitting around. I would just sit there, or I would try and read, or I would watch Sesame Street with the children, and I wouldn't do anything. I just hang around, which is not typical for me at all. So my wife said, listen, you know, you're not getting better. You want to be too much by yourself. Why don't you move out, because you're starting to annoy me. You know, you're starting to make me feel depressed.
While a person with clinical depression faces criticism from those around them, the harshest critic is often within. Deidre Oakley.
I mean, I think I, in my own mind, sort of stigmatized mental illness. There's these myths attached to it that I had myself, like, oh, it means you're unstable. It means you're weak. You know, you can control your behavior or your thoughts. I think stigma is the worst problem for people who suffer from any type of mental illness. And it prevents people from being able to be open about it.
A thorough medical evaluation is essential in the treatment of depression. Diagnosis is the first step to recovery.
I started to read every self-help psychology therapy book imaginable. I mean, you know the book racks and in the bookstore that say self-help. I was always there. Well, I picked up a book on insomnia, and there was a chapter in there that was all about depression. And then they had a sort of little thing where you could check off the boxes about the different symptoms. And, you know, one of them was feelings of foreboding, sleeplessness, anxiety. And so I went through it, and I ended up checking every one. And at the end it said, please see your doctor, you may be clinically depressed. And that's what prompted me to call my psychiatrist, and he said, why don't you come up and see me immediately or as fast as you can? And that's when my treatment started.
The only reason I didn't, actually, I have to say I did give up. I mean, I really gave up. And I said, okay, as far as my life is concerned, I've given up. But I cannot do something that'll hurt my children. So I just have to keep going. I don't have a choice. That's the only reason I kept going, for my children. At that point, I was very, very low, very, very depressed. And I happened to read in the unemployment section of the Boston Globe that the Mass General was having a depression study. So I thought, well, let's try it one more time, because I was really low. And because of that, I finally stumbled across something that helped.
Both Giovanni and Deidre received a full medical evaluation. Doctors treating clinical depression need to rule out thyroid disease, hormones, or other medical conditions. Since clinical depression is a hereditary disease, doctors also review each patient's family history. Following their diagnoses, both Giovanni and Deidre were given antidepressant medication. In Giovanni's case, after 14 years, the change was profound.
You may feel better for 3 or 4 days, and then all of a sudden you say, gee, it's not so bad. And you say, I relaxed for a minute, and I didn't feel the pain. I said, oh, wow. After a number of years, you say, oh, I don't see how anybody can make this better. But they did.
Within a week, that medicine started working. I mean, I all of a sudden felt like I was alive again. And I remember I started feeling better driving up from New York City with my brother, and we were listening to Muddy Waters or something, and I'm like humming along the blues kind of, and all of a sudden I just started to feel better. And I got to my parents' house, and I was like, I opened the refrigerator and wanted a cookie, and a glass of milk, and I was feeling kind of good. I was like, wow, I feel a lot better. That medicine is starting to work. And the next day I felt better, and I actually started feeling like I had a future. Like, the whole time I was in this depressed state, I almost felt like my life was over. All of a sudden, I was like, wow, there really is a life after depression.
Because of her experience with antidepressants, Deidre disagrees with the view that these medications are some kind of happy pills.
Like an aspirin stops a headache, an antidepressant will stop the symptoms that keep you from leading a normal, fulfilling life. It doesn't solve your problems, and it certainly doesn't make you happy. I didn't know if I wanted to continue in magazine publishing. I didn't know if I wanted to live in New York. I mean, by far my problems weren't solved. But the fact that I felt okay, physically, and the agitation and the sleeplessness were gone, allowed me to just get on with my life.
Irene Wozni was also treated with medication for her depression.
What these medications do for me is to restore for me more of a normal balance of certain chemicals in my brain. They don't make me happy. They don't make me elated. They make me feel like I'm a productive person, like I can think straight. I can read, I understand, I can laugh, I can get mad too, I can express myself. They don't make you overly happy. They don't make you out of control. They don't make you into somebody you're not.
Over the past 10 years, researchers have developed a new generation of antidepressants with far fewer side effects. As a result, most doctors now agree that for severe depression, treatment should start with medication. However, people with mild or moderate depression now have a choice. Two new short-term talk therapies have proven as effective as medication in treating less severe depressions. Dr. Ellen Frank's studies evaluated cognitive behavioral therapy, which focuses on negative thoughts and mood, and also interpersonal therapy, which examines patterns in personal relationships.
For less severe depressions, the talk therapies are every bit as effective as medication and can be used with complete confidence. Both of these treatments are usually offered for about 15 to 20 sessions. Another feature of these treatments is that they focus very much on the patient's current problems. They don't generally go back over the past very much, if at all. There's also a role for psychotherapy in those individuals who've had many depressions or many years of depression. These people need to learn how to live as a non-depressed person.
The medication for me keeps me from being depressed. The psychotherapy and the therapist is teaching me how to live as an undepressed person. I know how to live as a depressed person. That sort of came automatically after a number of years.
Giovanni was treated with cognitive behavioral therapy.
What happens in cognitive therapy, you examine your automatic assumptions that may not be true at all. So you say to the therapist, oh my God, I can't pay the mortgage this month. I'm going to be homeless. And the therapist will say, okay, your automatic assumption is you don't pay the mortgage for 1 month, you're going to end up homeless. Let's examine that assumption. Do you really think you're going to be homeless? Well, no, not really, because, you know, I can always borrow some money, or I can call up the mortgage company and say I didn't have the money this month and there's a penalty to pay, but that doesn't mean that they're going to throw me out. And what cognitive therapy does is it helps the patient see things in perspective.
While the two new talk therapies have provided a different approach to treating people in the depth of a depression, there is still a role for traditional long-term talk therapy. Julie Schneider is a 37-year-old human resources consultant. Shortly after the birth of her first son, she became clinically depressed. She's among the 1 in 10 women who are affected by postpartum depression after giving birth.
When I left the hospital after the birth of my son, I expected to be ecstatic and elated and high as a kite, and I was for like the first 24, 48 hours. And it didn't feel like it was a gradual onset of sadness. It was like the bottom fell out. I never would have expected to feel so horrible following something that was so wonderful.
Medication helped Julie fight her way out of a depression. Now she relies on traditional long-term talk therapy to help her reduce the stress of her daily life and fend off future episodes.
I went into therapy feeling that I was overwhelmed by all of the demands being placed on me in my life at that point in time. The work demands, the family demands. I learned a little bit about how to manage my time better so that when I could feel myself becoming stressed or overwhelmed, I could learn how to say no. And that was extremely valuable. It's important for me not to hit that threshold of stress where I can't handle it anymore, because when that happens, it triggers a real downward spiral for me. And the therapy really does help to prevent that from happening.
With a new arsenal of treatments available for clinical depression, more and more people are able to recover. Giovanni Gasparotto.
I'm self-employed now. I do finished carpentry and cabinet making and just general work that I find very pleasant, very challenging. It's difficult, but it's not impossible as it felt when I was very depressed. And I attribute the sense of hopefulness that I feel now to both the medication and the therapy together. that has made the difference.
Deirdre Oakley has left her job in magazine publishing. She's now working as a mental health researcher.
Well, I think going through a major depression myself really made me want to help people that might have similar experiences and not know what's wrong with them and be so desperate. Like, I was so desperate. We have an 800 number at work, so you do get people calling up who are looking for help. And I always say to them, I said, I really understand how you feel. You know, just hang in there. It will really get better.
The good news is that 8 out of 10 people with clinical depression will recover with proper treatment. But the bad news is more than half of those with the illness do not seek help. Those who go untreated are in grave danger. 1 in 10 people with severe clinical depression will commit suicide. Dr. Jan Fawcett specializes in the study of suicide and clinical depression.
The suicidal ideation is very common in depression once a person becomes hopeless, because if nothing's going to get better, there's no reason to be alive. And it becomes an urgency to die, to escape the pain.
Mary McAuliffe is a 56-year-old school teacher who has been depressed for 10 years and has not responded to treatment. The most serious symptom of her illness, she can't stop thinking about taking her own life.
I don't know, really, what was the actual thing that sent me to the bottom that fast, but I went to the bottom. And there are times when you just say, I can't do it anymore. I wish I were dead. I don't want to live anymore. And it sort of haunts you in the background of your mind. It's like an urge, a desire to end it all, to be over with it. It's enough.
Katrina Rivers is a 26-year-old paralegal. She had clinical depression for 10 years before she was treated.
When I pictured jumping from the top of buildings, I just wanted to be free of the pain. And I felt that if I jumped, I would feel like I was flying. At least one time, knowing what it was like to be free before I died. I look back on that now and I say, I don't understand my logic in that, but back then I thought the best thing for me to do would be to die, because I just thought I was the most awful person in the world.
For those who are severely depressed and suicidal, a hospital can be the safest place to recover. Again, Katrina Rivers.
When I went into the hospital, everyone was very comforting, and they said that it was the best thing I had done for my children and for myself. They understood what I was going through, and they weren't saying, well, get over it. Pick yourself up and go on. You know, they understood that my problem is an illness. It's not something that I can just get over on my own. I needed help. It was just a time for me to heal. If you're in the fire, you can't see a way out of the fire.
Clinical depression is a disease with many faces. People affected may not realize they have a mental illness and do not seek treatment. As you have heard, clinical depression is commonly mistaken for everyday sadness or other medical conditions. At the same time, depression can also be dismissed as winter blues or as a personality trait. In older people, it can be confused with the signs of aging, and in young people, it can be mistaken for adolescent rebellion.
The changes in my personality were extreme. In the beginning of 1 month, I was this innocent little girl, and at the end of that month, I was this rebellious, troublemaking kid.
Paige Watts is a 19-year-old freshman at the University of Maryland. She became clinically depressed 6 years ago. As often the case with teenage depression, she acted up instead of shutting down.
I was the average, like, fifth and sixth grader. I'd enjoyed doing what the other girls my age did. Like, if we played with Barbie dolls, we were all into playing with Barbie dolls. Or, like, you know, go do gymnastics at lunchtime, and when seventh grade rolled around, I was just all of a sudden so different from the person I was, and I completely disregarded anything my parents had to say. If they'd tell me, no, you can't go out, I'd be like, whatever, see ya, and walk out the front door. I'd come home drunk, and they'd know it, and I faked being sick a lot. I could have been hungover, I could have just been worn out, and I found myself saying, why me, and what is this? How can this be happening to me? I found myself saying that a lot.
Paige's mother, Marcy Watts.
I was certain that it was adolescence. It didn't fit any definition of depression that I knew. It was extreme. It was loud. It shows itself in emotional outbursts. Outbursts of behavior, extreme behavior, whether it's drugs or it's drinking or it's anger, that doesn't fit the title depression.
When I was down, I didn't like that at all, because I wasn't enjoying myself and no one else was either. That's just not like me.
Depression among older people is often overlooked. According to the National Institute of Mental Health, as many as 25% of people in nursing homes are affected. These are people who could have happiness and higher quality of life in their older years. Instead, their depression is often dismissed as aging. Julia Hoth became alarmed when her 76-year-old husband Arthur began to display signs of depression following the death of their son. But the doctor she contacted didn't see it.
They never really came up with what was wrong, except that they thought it was degeneration of the brain, aging, getting older, and you've got to expect these things, right? And that they thought he was going into Alzheimer's. I kept saying, well, there's got to be something more wrong with him.
Dr. Barry Leibowitz is chief of the mental disorders of the aging research branch at the National Institute of Mental Health and a leading expert on depression in older persons.
This case is absolutely typical. We see it every day. Everyone says, well, of course. You must be depressed. You can't live on your own anymore. You're too sick. You're too impaired. You're too disabled. So, of course, who wouldn't be depressed under those circumstances? And what we know is that if we don't treat the depression, that we will increase disability, increase the need for long-term institutional care in a nursing home, for example, and increase the likelihood of premature death. For example, depressed patients are up to 3 times more likely to die from heart disease as non-depressed patients.
The depression was a consistent low gray cloud. Something that would ordinarily be expected to give me joy would leave me feeling drained and lacking. And I didn't see an end to it. It continued.
George Brackett is a 53-year-old lecturer at the Harvard University Graduate School of Education. He has recovered from dysthymia, a mild depression without severe lows that goes on for 2 years or more. Dysthymia is a particularly insidious form of depression because it often disguises itself as someone's personality.
I thought I was a person who didn't have great highs or lows. So when I look at accomplishments, at building a family and teaching at Harvard and these kinds of accomplishments, which would make many people feel extremely proud, were only marginally okay to me. If every time you take up something that should give you joy and it doesn't, then you have to ask what else could be causing this. If you are depressed on a consistent, regular, chronic basis, there's something wrong. You got to ask why.
Another form of clinical depression, seasonal affective disorder, or SAD, affects 12 million Americans during the winter months when the days are shortest. Ardis Asayer is a 64-year-old former researcher for the National Institute of Health, and she had seasonal affective disorder for 49 years.
In the summer, I feel great. I'm sociable. I want to do things. I get up early, and I stay up late. You know, it just as though the sky's the limit. I'm able to handle almost anything. But the wintertime was always harder. The energy level drops, and by the time midwinter comes, I have just completely closed up. I have probably twice as many clothes as I need so that I have enough clean clothes to wear. Maybe I go to the grocery once a month, and then my self-esteem drops because of the fact that I'm not doing what I should be doing.
Ardis was treated for seasonal affective disorder by Dr. Norman Rosenthal of the National Institute of Mental Health. He himself has SAD and was part of the research team that discovered the disease as well as the most effective treatment for it, a simple device called the light box.
The treatment for SAD primarily is light therapy. One can use a light box, for example, and that can be set up on a desk or tabletop as long as the light is coming in through the eyes. Light hits the retina of the eye and is converted into nerve impulses that go back into the brain, there to be converted into chemical signals that reverse the symptoms of SAD. There are many other things that you can add to that, such as psychotherapy and antidepressants that enhance the primary treatment.
Finally, depression can appear as a stage of manic depressive illness, an entirely different mood disorder. Unlike clinical depression, people with manic depressive illness can cycle between ecstatic highs and crushing lows. One in 100 people have manic depression, and it's critical that they are correctly diagnosed. If a person with manic depression is given antidepressant medication without proper monitoring, the resulting upswing in mood can lead to a serious manic episode. Dr. Kay Jameson is a leading expert on depression and author of the best-selling book, An Unquiet Mind, a first-person account of her own experience with manic depressive illness. She cautions that antidepressant medications must be carefully prescribed and monitored.
Like with all medications, there are drawbacks and advantages. The advantages are that these drugs save lives and they make people's lives not only longer, but much more meaningful and much less miserable. The disadvantage is that we're often giving these drugs to people who may not need them, or people who may get worse as a result of them. And in this instance, I'm thinking particularly of manic depression.
17 million Americans are currently taking some type of antidepressant, and while the medications are a powerful tool to treat serious depression, Dr. Jameson wonders about potential long-range societal effects when they're used to cope with everyday stress or blues. She questions whether we are becoming a society intolerant of sadness.
We have a very huge social experiment going on at the moment. We've got millions and millions of people on antidepressants, and some of those people are not necessarily very sick. Likewise, we don't know the long-term effects on society of homogenizing personality and temperament. We don't know what the role of pain, anguish, melancholia, what roles these play in our society. And while nobody wants them at the individual level, it may be that these serve some evolutionary function or social function that we have to be very careful about.
Even though it is clear that clinical depression is a physical disease of the brain, health insurance companies treat it differently from other physical illness. This limits the accessibility of care for those who desperately need it. Again, Deirdre Oakley.
So I go to some insurance agency and I fill out the questionnaire. Well, in the questionnaire they asked if I had ever seen a psychiatrist. I said, oh yeah. And well, I get a phone call about 2 weeks later. My insurance was denied. They weren't going to take me. And I said, why? And they said, because of a pre-existing condition. And I said, well, what condition? No, at this point, I'm just like, what are you talking about? And it was the depression. So I couldn't get insurance.
Julie Schneider.
Psychotherapy in conjunction with the medication has been invaluable to me. I feel that I am functioning as well or better than I probably ever have in my life. And the fact that I am paying for most of this out of my own pocket really angers me when I'm paying health insurance premiums.
Lori Flynn is the executive director of the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill. She has lobbied strenuously for laws that would force insurance companies to treat mental illnesses like any other physical disability.
Over 95% of the health care plans in this country offer unequal, limited, and discriminatory coverage for mental illnesses like depression. What that means is, if you're an individual with depression, you will find that you do not have as many days of coverage for hospital care as you would for a physical illness. You will find even that you don't have the same amount of care on an outpatient basis visiting your doctor or therapist. It doesn't make sense, it's not good policy, and it really hurts people who indeed can be helped by current treatment.
This approach by insurance companies is short-sighted considering the effect that clinical depression has on the nation. According to a study by the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, clinical depression results in 1.3 billion lost workdays in America each year. This means that for the average company, 3% of workers' productivity is lost to clinical depression. Employers have begun to respond. Carol Trawick is the Chief Executive Officer of Trawick & Associates, a Washington, D.C.-based computer firm.
It hits the bottom line directly because if you're constantly treating symptoms, you have higher medical...
Amram, through his children, gets two positions of leadership in the Jewish people, the position of Melech, which is Moshe Rabbeinu, and the position of Kohen Gadol, which is Aaron. But he felt any other position should go to the children of the second oldest child of Kohath, who is Yitzhar, and that would make Korach, instead of going to the youngest, to the child of the youngest son of Kohath, which is Uzziel, Elisaphan ben Uzziel. And therefore Rashi says, that was the slight to Korach's dignity which caused him to rebel. Now you'll notice he never says that. In the Chumash, that's not what he says at all. But that's the whole point. Korach argues everybody's the same. But really what bothers him is he did not get the kavod that he wanted to get. Well, it was Al-Pi Hashem. Yeah, but remember, what Korach is doing is Korach, at this point, is blinded to that fact. And Korach... Now, we don't know if Korach convinced himself. This is always going to be a problem. Did Korach believe? Because you can delude yourself into many things. Korach's position is that Moshe made up a lot of these things. I mean, that's exactly Korach's position. The question is, did he delude himself into believing that? Or is he just lying? The Midrashim seem to imply that the power of jealousy is so strong that you convince yourself of things that are clearly not the case. In other words, Korach was not a liar, but rather he honestly believed in his own mind. He twisted things around that Moshe Rabbeinu simply made up things at this point. And, you know, we understand this, I think, in our own lives, that jealousy can destroy a person's judgment and a person's perspective, and a person begins to see things that are not even there. Okay, the alternative would be Korach is simply lying. But again, to say that he's lying, I mean, that's kind of foolish, because he's entering a battle that he knows he can't win. In other words, if he knows that HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Moshe Rabbeinu so-and-so, So who does Korach think he's going to defeat? Right? I mean, the only plausible scenario is that because of his jealousy, he began to not see things in their true light.
Can you just go over one more time what the agendas of all the people in Korach's group were?
Okay.
Korach was jealous. Yeah. Reuven was jealous that the Avoda was...
Yeah, Reuven was jealous that the Avoda was taken away from the firstborn, which was Reuven, and given to the Shevet Levi. So in effect, the Reuven people wanted to be like the Levim. The Levim were jealous that they were subordinate to Kohanim. So the Levim wanted to be like Kohanim. Dasan and Aviram, generally, although they're from Reuven, they generally didn't like Moshe Rabbeinu too much, and they wanted to get rid of Moshe Rabbeinu. That's the group. Korach wanted the Nesias of Shevet Levi. The Levim wanted to be like Kohanim. The Bechorim wanted to be like the Levim. That's everybody. Everybody wanted to be as somebody else.
I thought you also really. What they also said that this is the point of view to bring would never get to align Israel.
Yeah,
that was an underlying thing that they were.
Yeah,
really
the Ramban says specifically. Yeah, there's a machlokus when Korach occurred. By the way, in other words, if you look in the Chumash, Korach occurred after the incident of the spies. The Ibn Ezra says it actually took place before. The Ibn Ezra says it occurred as soon as the Levim were chosen, which was earlier.
Mm-hmm.
But the Ramban says exactly your point. The Ramban says that the atmosphere which allowed for people to be attracted to be malcontent was the fact that now it was decreed. In other words, the Ramban makes the point that until the Cheder Meraglim, nobody would dare rebel against Moshe, because all they've gotten were good things. With the sin of the golden calf, Moshe prayed for them and spared their lives. But with the Cheder Meraglim, we see for the first time that Moshe Rabbeinu's tefilos were not totally effective. Moshe Rabbeinu spared them from getting destroyed, which is worth something, but Moshe Rabbeinu could not annul Hashem's decree. And the Ramban makes the point that realizing that they're going to be wandering in the desert for many years made them, it's kind of, what have you done for me lately type of feeling, that made them prone to not being grateful to Moshe. So now that was not the specific ground for jealousy, but that is what allowed Korach's rebellion to be accepted and for people to listen to, because of this gezeirah.
Is this the only time the Levim got out of hand? Because usually they rallied to the right side.
Well, it doesn't record a lot of them, and Rashi says that the bulk of the 250 people who joined with Korach were from Shevet Reuven. But this is the one instance, really, where some Levim, at least. And of course, we know that Korach was a great, you know, Korach's sons survived. You know, Korach's sons, they fell in, but they managed, they did shuvah at the last minute. And we know that the Levim who sang in the Beis Hamikdash were descended from Korach. You may recall, you may read Tehillim that says, Lam Natseach Livnei Korach. That is the Korach. That is the Korach of infamy. That the Levim were descended from Korach. And Korach's most famous descendant was the Navi Shmuel. Shmuel, the prophet Samuel, is descended from Korach. And according to one Medrash, the reason why Korach had delusions of grandeor was because he saw with Ruach HaKodesh that the prophet Shmuel would come from him. And there's a pasuk in Tehillim that compares Shmuel to Moshe and Aaron. We say it Friday night. It says, Moshe the Aaron b'chohanav. Moshe and Aaron are Hashem's priests. Ushmuel b'korei Shmo. And Shmuel is also those who call unto Hashem. And Chazal even say that Shmuel is equal to Moshe and Aaron together. So Korach looked. He saw he had a Shmuel Hanavi coming from him. So he figured he was greater than Moshe Rabbeinu. You know, so Korach, in fact, I'll tell you a word from the Ari, an amazing thought from the Ari about the greatness of Korach. The Ari says, following Gematria, this is a phenomenally interesting Gematria, says, take the numerical equivalent of Moshe. So Moshe is 345. Okay, is that right? 345, yeah. Then you take Korach, which is 308, and you take Hevel, you know, the Hevel who died, Hevel is 37. So he says, Moshe minus Hevel equals Korach. Now we'll explain what that means. If you take Moshe, which is 348, minus Hevel, which is 37, that gives you 308. I'm sorry, Moshe is 345. 345 minus 37 is 308. So Korach equals Moshe without the Heva. This is what the Ari writes. So what is the significance of this? So if we go back to Cain and Heva, and we look at their names, and we know that names are very important, right? Names illustrate what a person's personality is. In fact, that's why the name that a child is given at a bris is very important. The Ari writes elsewhere that whatever name parents give a child is kind of a prophecy, unintentional prophecy as to the nature of the child. And that's why there is a concept, according to some, that even if the name that is given is the wrong name, I've been at the bris, actually, I've seen the same rabbi do two different things at two different brises. Sometimes it happens that the mohel or whoever is doing the naming doesn't hear the parent right and gives the baby a different name. Like the parents wanted Shlomo and the namer said Shalom. Or I've even heard cases where a Zaidi, a grandfather or an uncle was named, the uncle didn't like the parent's name. The parents picked a name that the uncle didn't like. The uncle just said a different name, you know. And the question becomes, can you correct that? Can you correct that? So I was at one bris where the namer said Shalom, and the mother was saying, no, Shlomo, Shlomo. And the rabbi there said, I'm sorry, May Hashem Yatzah HaDavar, this comes from Hashem, that this is the name the baby has. We don't know why, and therefore the baby has to be Shalom. I was at another bris where they allowed a correction. But
I thought it's so easy to correct the name.
It really isn't. Well, there is a concept that the name a person is given at a bris. It is for women. It's actually easier because there's not a bris, so to speak. So with a woman is named when you're called up to the Torah. So the same way you give the name the first time, you can give the name the second time. But with a man, unless a man chas v'shalom is very ill, then there's a concept of adding a name. But generally speaking, the name of a bris should not be changed. That's right. There is a concept. There is a concept of that being a prophecy as to the child's essential nature. Of course, that doesn't address the issue of mistake, because who gave, you know, the person the authority to pick?
How is it like a Yiddish name that someone changed? But I know in my own family, I think that it was considered to go up with the Hebrew name as opposed to the Yiddish name or something like that.
Well, you know, you could call yourself up, you know, a person could be called up to the Torah with any name he wants, because it's not a legal thing. But if it comes to something like the ksuva or a get that has to have the right name. See, so we can be very lenient as to being called up to the Torah, but you have to be very careful. You have to ask a shaila about that. That a legal document, it does have to have a person's halachic name.
You name a child for a particular person and you give them a Hebrew version of that Yiddish name.
Yeah.
Have you broken that?
Well, you know, it's a complicated thing. The concept of naming a child after someone has two connotations. There is a Kabbalistic idea that part of the neshama lives on in the child. And that only works if it's exact. If it's not exact, it doesn't work. Then there's another concept of commemorating, giving kavod to somebody, so that approximations are good as well. For example, middle names don't count, or adaptations of male to female do not count in terms of the neshama being perpetuated. But there still might be what is called kavod. So if somebody was an Avraham, and I want to name someone after Avraham, after one Zaidi, an Avraham and a David. So you can call somebody Avraham David, but you're not perpetuating either neshama there. That's why in certain families you'll notice there are never any middle names. They always name only one of the other.
Names, you're not perpetuating.
There's an element of kavod that you're showing, but the perpetuation of the neshama requires the exact correspondence. I was saying that there are people who, if you want to name somebody after somebody, you have to have the exact name of that person. You can't combine another person's name in it. Now, I'll tell you an interesting origin. You know the name Schneier, which is not, it's a little Babbage name, but you know, it's a Hebrew name. But Schneier, it's an invented name. Where did Schneier come from? Because a baby was born. This goes back around 300 or 400 years ago. And there were two grandfathers. One was named Meir, and the other was named Shraga. Shraga is Aramaic for candle. And Meir is also illumination. So they didn't know which grandfather to name it after. So Schneor, two lights. It's a made-up name, Schneor. Yeah, so it's a made-up name for that in that sense. Just like Harry S. Truman, you know, the S. There's no period after S. His middle name was S. because he said he had two grandparents, both of whom had a name S, and his parents didn't want to decide which one he was named after. Yeah, that's right. When I say it doesn't count, I mean two things. Meaning to say, the concept of perpetuating a neshama does not count if you name a girl after a man, or name a man after a woman, name a baby after a woman. It doesn't count in that way. It's still a way of giving kavod. You can give honor to somebody.
Rabbi,
that's all right.
We just had that situation.
Yeah.
And my children questioned it. We named our grandson after my mother.
Uh-huh.
And what they said was that there's a Hasidic tradition that you go by the letters. My mother's name was Mindo.
Uh-huh.
They named the baby Menachem Daniel. The two of them had the letters Mindo.
I see. So as long as the letters are in the name, they thought that
this
was
good. This is what we were told.
Well,
have you heard anything?
I have not heard that. But you know, again, as I say, the concept of giving honor to someone, that you can do in many ways, you know, mm-hmm. the kind of giving honor, but the actual mystical idea of perpetuating the neshama, that you don't have unless there's exact correspondence. Mm-hmm.
Well, can I ask you, there's one more question. We have in our family a ancestor, who is great and beloved, who three children were named after, and all three children came to an early death. And nobody wants to take the chance that maybe the child after this.
Did this person himself die?
Quite young, yeah. Well, in the 40s, young woman.
Well, what people do is this. That's a very scary thing, because in fact it is brought down, the halacha, that it is customary that if someone dies at a young age, you do not name a child after that person. What you do in that case is, though, you can add a name. In other words, their bedafka, you don't want to have an exact correspondence, and you can commemorate somebody by taking the name, but you should add something else to it.
So you can name the name, but the middle name is different.
Well, I would suggest you could do that, or I would suggest the first name be different, actually.
The first name should be different and the middle name.
And the first name should be something like Chaim. You know, depending on the words, names that connote life. Chaim or Chaya, Rafael, Rafaela.
Herself was given the name Alter, so she must have been sickly, we think.
Yeah.
And so what name would be the proper name then? Now when a person has a name added, her name was Luma, and then she became Alta. Alta is...
Was that added when she was sick?
Alta, don't they give that name the name Alta when, as to trick the angel of death, that the person they think is old and they don't take them?
Alta is one of the names that we add to a person when they're ill. We add.
So we don't know, but we think. The woman was a sickly woman who died at about the age 49.
Yeah.
And... So what name would you give to commemorate that person?
As what additional name?
Well, I mean, you can give them. Say you wanted to name a child. You give a name.
Right. No, you could call
then
it Bluma.
You call it Bluma?
You could call Chaya. You call Chaya Bluma.
Chaya
Bluma.
Bluma.
You could do that. Yeah. Okay.
Is the name given on to living cells? Such as in this case, the Alta, is that part of the...
No, it depends. I'm not sure about the circumstance. If you're talking about a name, when someone has a name added when they're sick, and they do not become better, they die from the sickness, that name drops off. It's not used anymore. If they recover, it becomes part of the
legal document.
Yes.
Part of the name or the complete name?
Well, it all depends. If a name is added when someone is ill and the person recovers from the illness, it becomes their permanent name.
And the whole case, Bluma would have been?
Alta Bluma.
It would have been both names.
Both names. No. They never take away the old name. They add a name, but it's added. It's not. Yeah. But if someone dies from the illness, you drop it. You don't use the name change anymore.
In other words, the children would not be called as the child of the mother.
The
new name. And,
if the mother died of the sick,
died,
that's correct.
Yeah.
That's correct. You don't. Well, Alta in Yiddish means old. Old. So it's a type of word that suggests that Hashem should give this person a long life. In other words, the names that are typically added Although it could be any name, really, because the Holy Sod is any Shinui Hashem could be a good thing. But, you know, we add names like Chaim, life, or Chaya. Yosef, mm-hmm. may God add on. Sometimes Yosef Chaim, may God add on life. Raphael, or Raphaela, which Raphael means the God heals. Names that suggest this. Alta is also a name that suggests there should be a long life. These are names. But the essence of the idea is the notion that any change of name might be beneficial. So it doesn't have to be a change of name in that direction. There is a ceremony. There is you should have a minion of people, and there are tehillim that are said, and there are prayers that are recited.
It's not automatic.
No, it should be
done. When they give them a shabarak, it doesn't automatically happen that you get chaya added to your name.
No. You should do it. You should do it with a minion, and things should be said. There is a ceremony for changing the name.
I have two questions. First one, how far back does it date the perpetuation of neshama? When did it actually start? And my other question is, that the Sfaradim name after a living people?
Yeah, Sfaradim name, you can have a junior in Sfaradim. Yeah.
So, I mean,
I can't tell you how early. I mean, the Ashkenazic custom is very old. We're talking about at least 1,000 years old. Mm. I mean, I know we can go back that far, but it may go back even much further than that. But the concept of naming people after in memory goes back a very, very long time. And of course, you can even trace it in Tanakh when you notice in Nehemiah and other books of lineage that there are grandchildren who bear names of grandparents. So.
But was that for perpetuation?
We don't know why, but you do see the reoccurrence of names, which mm-hmm. may suggest that as a possibility. But I just wanted to go back to Cain and Hevel, just to bring up the Ari's point, that Cain comes from acquisition, right? Konisi. And we know that in Biblical Hebrew, the word kano can mean both to acquire and to create. When Malchitzedek praises Hashem as the Konei Shamayim Va'aretz in Lech Lecha, we know that Konei does not literally mean over there the acquirer of heaven and the earth, but it refers to the creator. Konei can also mean the creator of heaven and earth. So the Ari says that Kayan represents the impulse of the human being to acquire, to create, to master, to dominate, to control, which indeed we associate with the characteristics of Kayan. Now, if we look at the Shorish of Hevel, we know what Hevel means. Hevel means breath. Remember in Koheles we have the constant refrain, Havel Havelim, all of the world is like a breath. Now what is a breath? A breath is a vapor. It's nothingness. That represents that which is transitory, ephemeral, temporary, of no lasting value. And the Ari points out that these are good and bad, that Kayan's midos are very necessary, but can also be very destructive. It's necessary for a human being to have the impulse to create and to form and to accomplish in the world. Hevel was very, very passive. Hevel was humble and submissive. But in his submissiveness, there's a passivity. In fact, the Ari points out, if you look at even Korbanos, if we ask who was the first person who introduced the concept of a korban as a way of propitiating HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it was not Hevel, it was Kayan. Kayan innovated the concept of the korban. What Hevel did was, Hevel imitated what Kayan did, but he improved on it. Hevel, Hevi, Gamhu, me too. Somewhat like the Japanese, right? You take American technology and you improve on it, but you don't innovate, you don't create. So in effect, Hevel represents the notion of submission and humility. But the flip side of that is a certain passivity, not going into the world and accomplishing. The Ari says Moshe Rabbeinu was a Gilgal, was a reincarnation of Hevel. And Moshe Rabbeinu rectified the passivity of Hevel. Because on one level, Moshe Rabbeinu incorporated the humility of Hevel. Moshe is the Anav Mikol Adam, the humblest person. But he also demonstrated the capacity for leadership and initiative. In effect, Moshe Rabbeinu incorporated Hevel's Midas, but only on the positive side and not the negative side, not the lethargy or the passivity that would come. Now, going with this Mahalach, we could say this. Korach had many of the positive attributes of Moshe Rabbeinu. He had the understanding. In fact, there's a medrash that says Korach understood the mystery of even the Parah Aduma, the red heifer, which we're going to read about in next week's Parsha, which is the greatest mystery of the Torah. Korach was able to understand this. He had the organizational ability, he had the talents, he had the enthusiasm, he had the passion. But what he lacked was the dimension of hevel, the humility and the submissiveness. So now the Aris Gematria works perfectly. Who was Korach? He was Moshe without the hevel. That Moshe's greatness was he combined his immense talents with a sense of the humility and the submission to the will of Hashem. Korach had all of those talents, but he didn't have the hevel. And therefore, even numerically, as represented, numerically, Korach, Moshe minus hevel equals Korach. That's the only thing Korach was lacking. So we see the tremendous tragedy, therefore. There's a certain tragedy here. The tragedy of a person with many, many qualities of greatness who gets destroyed and blinded by jealousy. See, it's not just, you know, this is not just the story of an unsuccessful rebellion that HaKadosh Baruch Hu crushed, but it's the tragedy of a person who had such potential for greatness, and yet because he didn't have the dimension of Hevel within him, he was totally destroyed. And that is why a Shmuel could come from a Korach, because remember, there's a conservation of energy principle here in the spiritual realm. If Korach had all of these great qualities, they can't be destroyed totally. They have to come out somewhere. They couldn't come out in Korach, because Korach's jealousy destroyed the possibility of that potential coming out. But they eventually manifested themselves in Shmuel and in the Levium who sang Shira to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Just like, as we know, the same story with Rus. This notion that holiness can never be destroyed. It always, if it's there, it'll always come out somewhere. That's, of course, the ultimate story of Rus herself. That the holiness that Lot absorbed from Avraham Avinu, even if it could not come out in Lot's, because of Lot's selfishness and Lot's preoccupation with material acquisition, which is why he moved to Sodom, but that holiness found a place till it finally became manifest in Rus. That holiness that came from Avraham. So you have a similar idea with Korach. So this is an amazing idea that in effect Korach was very, very great, but the jealousy destroyed him. And so in a way there's a kind of a Greek tragedy, I'll have the dimension, of the heroic person who gets destroyed by the internal flaw of character that is within. And what's so paradoxical is, you know, the Baal Shem Tov says a beautiful thing. The Baal Shem Tov says that when we hold up magnifying glasses to look at the flaws of another, right? We like to hold up magnifying glasses. He says, it's really a mirror that is turned in onto yourself. And that is, he says, the flaws that we identify in others almost always are a sign of what we have within ourselves. And that's why Korach, of all things, could accuse Moshe of power grabs. He accuses Moshe of arrogance. He accuses Moshe of trying to control people. When in reality, Moshe is totally free of those things. But Korach makes the accusation, because that's exactly what is within himself. And I think I prefer to look at this not as a person who's simply lying, but the Musar is much more powerful when we look at self-delusion. Korach is not simply lying, but he convinced himself that this was true. Because that is the power of a person who is so consumed with jealousy that his judgment can no longer be accurate.
Well, it's interesting in terms of the conservation and the rectification of errors in earlier lives.
Right.
Samuel then gave up power.
That's right. That's
after
right.
He had won, he was the final judge. And then he actually gave up power and played the king.
That's a very excellent point. In a way, you could say that Shmuel rectified Korach. Korach is arguing for more power. Shmuel actually abdicated. That's correct, towards the end of his life, by making the king. That's an excellent point.
Who would that time not be
Oh, well, I don't have a complete list of that. In other words, in terms of who their reincarnation of?
No, Nicholas. Who did they go back to?
Well, they're from Reuven.
From Reuven.
I don't know if we have anything.
Grandchildren or...
I mean, look, I think with the Parshas Pinchas, we're given a partial yichus.
And also, why were they such troublemakers?
Well, you know, you have
to... And they got away with it.
Yeah. That's a very interesting point, because the amazing thing is, we are told that 4/5 of the Jewish people died in Mitzrayim during the 3 days of darkness, right? Only 1/5 of the Jewish people left. And Dasan and Aviram are in that 1/5. So you wonder, gee, you know, these are the guys who made it. Then what were the other people? Why didn't Dasan and Aviram? Yeah, so they Taka say, they say Ipshat. They ask Bekasha, why didn't Dasan and Aviram perish with the 4/5? I mean, they're certainly not righteous people. And it says they had a merit. The merit of Dasan and Aviram were that they were, if you remember, they were taskmasters over the Jewish taskmasters, the Sorim Nisim. And Chazal say that a number of times the taskmasters took the punishment. If the Jews didn't make their quota, the taskmasters blamed it on themselves and they took the punishment from the Egyptians. So it says, Dasan v'Avirim were taskmasters. So they had a tremendous chus that in spite of everything, they took whippings for the rest of Bnei Yisrael. And that was the chus. In other words, on many levels, they may not have been deserving. And maybe this only happened once. We don't even know how many times they did this. But that was the merit that allowed them to kind of hang around. Anyway, we don't want Moshe Rabbeinu's job to be too easy. You know, Moshe needs a test.
Who made the point of the magnifying glass when we see a moment?
The Baal Shem Tov says that the magnifying glass is a mirror.
Yeah.
Chazal really said it too. Chazal said it in a less dramatic way. Chazal said, Kol ha-posel, it's a Gemara, Kol ha-posel v'muma hu-posel. When you disqualify others, you are pointing to a blemish that is within yourself. So,
I think
that's
in Hebrew,
or someone shabbat al-tagid l'asher. Yeah, that's also, it's a medrash. Yeah, it's from Chazal, right. I just want to see if Dasan Baviram's yichus is traced here at all. No, we don't. Oh, yes. Okay. I'll give you the yichus exactly. Reuven had 4 sons: Chanoch, Halu, Chetzron, and Carmi. Okay, these are 4 sons of Reuven. Palu, who is the 4th son, had a son Eliav. And Eliav had 3 sons. Dasan v'Aviram even had a brother. Nemuel, Dasan, v'Aviram. Yeah, because they were brothers. Right. And it makes a point, and this is the Dasan v'Aviram who we talked about before, who always fought up against Moshe and died in the rebellion against Korach. So Nemuel was a brother, but there's a 3rd brother who wasn't a bad guy. 3rd brother survived and actually entered Eretz Yisrael. Because all the people listed in Pinchas are the generation, this is the new generation that is entering the land of Israel.
Did Onan ben Pelech just say that he was not caught up in the jealousy, he didn't have his own agenda, and
it's very interesting. It's actually the opposite. This explains another thing. Onan ben Pelech, remember, he's the man, he's only mentioned in the first pasuk, and he drops out of sight. So Chazal basically say that his wife talked him out of it. But because of this, see, he probably was a real disinterested egalitarian. He thought, gee, we're going to abolish hierarchy. So Mrs. Ohn told him, listen, if Moshe wins, you're going to be under him. And if Korach wins, you're going to be under him. You're going to be second no matter what. So she talked him out of it because there was no point. And then, you know, Chazal say also, when Korach's group came to get him, so she gave her husband a lot of fermented milk that made him fall asleep, and she uncovered her hair, and then they didn't want to enter the tent, and it's a whole mindset. But basically, he was dissuaded by the argument that you'll gain nothing out of this.
He wasn't the greatest
of subject. No, not that. He could have had his own agenda. He thought, gee, you know, everyone's looking for fire, maybe I'll get something. And she said, you know, you're not in the running for anything. So at that point, there was no point in doing it. So this is just a perspective about Korach to think about the notion of the jealousy that destroys us. And indeed, because, you know, the pasuk says in Mishlei that jealousy is called a rekev atzamos. It's a rotting of the bones, something that's inside of a person that eats them up and eats them up and eats them up, and they can't go on with their life. But I want to go back to the idea of techeles for a second. I'm not sure, I may have some of this last week, that why does Korach use, why does Korach use the mashal of the blue of the tzitzis? Of the blue of the tzitzis. And here, let's reflect on the fact that in the time when there was, again, the where does the tcheles come from? The tcheles comes from a creature that is called the chilazon. Chilazon. Now what is the chilazon? So there are many different opinions what the chilazon is. Some thought it was a squid or a cuttlefish. Those are fish that have this ink that comes out. But most poskim identify the chilazon with a non-kosher shellfish, a type of snail. Not really a fish, but a type of sea snail that's in a shell. The jansina is one type. There are a number of shells. Now, the interesting thing about the chilazon is this. The secretion itself is not blue. It's a secretion. It's a liquid secretion. It's actually it's kind of yellowish. But it's treated with certain chemicals, because Gemara lays this out, and the chemical reactions turn it into the indigo or the bluish dye. And this was well known. This is not a uniquely Jewish dye. This was well known in Roman cultures and Greek cultures, royal blue and royal purple. And in fact, historically, you know, you read in the Gemara sometimes that at various points, the Romans decreed that any Jew wearing techeles will be executed, things like that. And, you know, we read it and we think, well, this is just another Roman gezeira because of religious, they want to stop us from keeping our religion. Not true. Historically, in the Roman Empire, this blue dye was so treasured and was so expensive that there was a law about anybody. If you were not in the royal family, or you were not a senator over in Rome, you weren't allowed to wear it. So the reason Jews weren't allowed to wear tcheles at various times in history was not because of religious persecution, but simply because it was against the law for anyone to appropriate this color if they were not a designated government official or in the royal family. So this was well known. Now, there's a whole discussion now in Eretz Yisrael. Some people have claimed to have rediscovered the shellfish. They've identified it, and they're selling techeles, and you might see people wearing techeles. Other people say that the identification is not conclusive. The Radziner Hasidim, which is a group of Hasidim in Poland, their Rebbe claimed to have rediscovered the Techeles around 70 years ago. They've been wearing Techeles ever since, but many say that that was a fake. Not that the Rebbe, Chas Hashem, deliberately did something false, but that the Rebbe was fooled by a dishonest chemist, because chemical analysis shows that the Radziner Techeles, the secretion, is an inert ingredient that plays no role in the color. In other words, the concept was they took the secretion, they added a bunch of chemicals, they came up with blue. But chemical analysis shows that you'd come up with blue even if the secretion would have been water. The secretion contributed nothing to the chemical reaction, which means it couldn't be tcheles, because Masha Einen, the newer thing, the secretion does contribute to the formation of the color. The other one is inorganic, essentially. But be it as it may, there is a discussion whether we have techeles, don't have techeles. But when you have techeles, I don't know if you've ever seen that tzitzis with techeles, you have either two strings, right, tzitzis are eight strings, four strings folded over. So you either have a whole string that's blue, which would be two strings, or you only have a half string that's blue, which is one string. Okay, this is a machlokas, how you have it. Some people have two full strings, which would make it four. Four techeles and four lovin. Now we know, I think I mentioned last week, the Gemara, that what does techeles remind us of? Techeles reminds us, ultimately, of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. How does it remind us of HaKadosh Baruch Hu? So Chazal say, through an indirect process, that techeles reminds us of the ocean, the blue of the ocean. And the ocean reminds us of the sky. And the sky reminds us of the divine throne of glory. And again, I don't remember if I talked about this last week or not. Did I? Okay. But I wanted to add one thing. If the techeles reminds us of Hashem, why do we have white in our tzitzis? That's, I know I didn't mention last week. Why is the concept of white? Why do you have white and techeles? Part of the idea is, therefore, if looking at the blue reminds us of our potential to achieve a relationship with Hashem, looking at the whites reminds us how far we have to go. The white is without the color. The white is empty. The white isn't there yet. And therefore, the Techeles reminds us of who we can become. But the Lavan reminds us that we're not there yet and we still have a process that we have to follow. And that's why you need Lavan and Techeles. Because you have to keep your eye on the aspiration of reaching the Kisei HaKavod, the throne of glory. But you also have to have the white to remind you that you're not complete. And Korach's mistake is in thinking that you're all blue. We're all Techeles already. We're already there. We're already holy. And his mistake was, once again, the fact that he chose the example of a talis that's totally blue. His mistake was, Korach, you can't have a talis that's totally blue. You have to recognize the Lavan as well. And again, the Lavan is connected to the humility. Well, women don't have, you know, that particular commandment. You're right. It's a number of things that women don't have. According to halacha, a woman is permitted to wear tzitzis. Now, again, this is a whole controversy. It says that a woman should not wear a talis because that is the garment of a man. And as is always the case, a woman shouldn't wear a man's garment and a man shouldn't wear a woman's garment. But if a woman has a shawl of four corners. See, tzitzis can be put should be put on any garment that has four corners, squared. So there's actually nothing wrong with a woman having tzitzis on a shawl or the like. And when there was techeles, you could have techeles on that. You would be permitted to do so. Again, in a normal Orthodox synagogue, that tends not to be encouraged that much. But according to halacha, you really could not discourage it, because the principle is this. Why are women exempt from tzitzis? Why are they exempt? They're exempt for a very simple reason. It's a time-bound commandment, because tzitzis are worn only in the daytime and not worn at night. Right? That's the halacha. You don't wear a talis at night. So the same principle that says a woman is exempt from taking lulav and sitting in the sukkah, because those are time-bound commandments, only 7 days a year, they're exempt from tzitzis. Now, based on that logic, the same logic that says if a woman wants to sit in the sukkah, she makes a bracha. And if a woman wants to take a lulav, she makes a bracha, would also say she could take tzitzis. Except for the fact that a talis is a garment of a man, but if it's feminized, so to speak, it would be the same as sitting in a sukkah on a volunteer basis.
I have had a conscience. Right. I don't know anymore. Right. And it's square. And you
have to
ask. Would I be required?
Well, you're not required, as I say, because women are exempt from the mitzvah of tzitzis, because it's a time-bound... That's right, even if it's four-cornered. The only thing is, you would be allowed to do it, and according to this, you'd be allowed to make a bracha on it. You would not be required. If your husband were to wear it, he would have to wear tzitzis. People don't realize this all the time. You have to be careful occasionally, that the mitzvah of tzitzis is any garment that has four square corners must have tzitzis on it. You're not allowed. A man is not allowed to wear any four-cornered square garment.
You know, there are
some absolutely
shirts that they make for men that that have a cut there.
Right.
And my husband was once told that sew it so that it's not square.
That's right. That's just you try to round it off or yeah.
An ordinary scarf that you wear in the wintertime.
No, well, no. It has to be big enough. It has to be a garment that covers most of the torso. But if it is a shirt that covers most of the torso, you do have to have six of them. Yeah. Unless you cut one of the corners so it's not squared. Yeah.
I think that sissies protect men from kind of unintentional anger.
Well, tzitzis is considered to be a protection. You know, the Gemara has a story about a man who was once going to be with a prostitute, as it were, and the last minute, as he was undressing, his tzitzis slapped him in the face. So it reminded him of not sinning. So the truth is, tzitzis is a reminder. You know, it is a reminder. A person looks at the tzitzis. That's why, ideally, as you know, tzitzis should be worn outside the... garment. We have a heter. It is said that when we live among non-Jews, we don't have to do it. But you know, if you ever see the among Hasidim and among many people in Eretz Israel, they even wear the talis kata, not just over their shirt. And that's the way it was done in the shtetl in Europe.
Well, the tzitzis are not worn at night in this story, but
Well, we don't have to take them. Well, that was during the day. Yeah. Well.
Yeah, I'm just saying, in terms of wearing it at night, what is why? Why can't you be reminded at night as well?
Well, the Torah describes stitches as something that you can see.
Yeah, I guess.
And the concept was when they didn't have lights. You know, yeah. But
in other words, we would not change.
Well, yeah, because it's based on what was the situation when the Torah was written. But there is a... I'll tell you a problem. Now, there is even an issue about... I'm trying to remember what we do. If you have a square blanket, a square woolen blanket, that is used during the day for naps, there is a problem whether you need stitches on it.
Now, do you have to make a bracha when you cover yourself with it?
Well, you would.
So each time you would put on, in the course of a day, if you changed the shirt, let's say,
whenever you put on a four-cornered garment, you put on
the
mega
bracha.
Sure.
What makes tzitzis puzzle? I mean, aside for the number of knots and...
What makes the fringes puzzle?
Yeah.
No, the fringes don't have to be even, but you do have to have... four whole strings. Now, that means to say, you could be missing. As long as you have four strings and even a little bit of the other four, that would be okay. You don't need all eight. You need the four whole strings and a little bit of a fold over. And then, I'll tell you, something that is a very serious psul is if one of the strings is cut as it goes through the loop. Sometimes you can have, you put four strings through a hole and then you tie them and knot them. Now, sometimes one of them might be cut all the way up there, meaning to say that one of your strings is a loose thread that's just knotted in, as opposed to going through the baguette. And that is puzzle.
And you have if to it notice. Starts raveling or unraveling, in terms of because the bottom, if the wool starts to...
That's okay. That's
okay,
by and large okay. If it starts unraveling, if most of it is unraveled, it's a problem. But you can have some fuzziness at the bottom, is all right.
Rabbi, was the garment itself also tzchelet, or could that have been white?
The garment could be brown or red or any color.
I mean, what the men actually wore is tzitzit, not that you put them on any garment that has four corners.
See, you have to keep in mind that the concept of a talus just represented then the shawl that people wore in the streets. The garment a Jew wore in the street had fringes on it.
So when we talk about tzchelet, we're really talking about the tzitzis.
The right. That's right.
But it's really just representation. It's not really a garment per se that men wear. Because it's not, you wouldn't wear that as all alone. That's not very garment.
Well, it was considered to be like an overgarment, a coat, as it were.
Uh-huh.
No, but those were common. Men wore shawls or different types of...
But nowadays, right. Men just don't wear, they don't wear...
So nowadays... Well, what makes it a men's garment? I mean, in a way, it's become a men's garment because women customarily didn't wear it. So, you're right, there's a certain circularity to that, but once something has become a garment that is customarily not worn by women, so the first woman who wears it might be violated. Maybe the second woman who wears it isn't, but the concept is you don't start doing it because at that point it's treated as a baguette-ish.
But colors that men do not wear.
Oh, so I'm saying that might be. Well, but some men do wear it. But as I'm saying, I'm not telling people to
right.
buy a talus and wear it. All I'm saying is that according to the strict halacha, a woman would be permitted to wear tzitzis in a garment and even make a bracha over it, as long as it would not be the type of talus that is commonly worn by men in their shul. Now, tefillin is another issue. Tefillin is a different controversy.
Can I ask a question before the question of, is it the squaring of the garment, or is it the fringes that were supposed to be maybe with a blanket, or what makes
it... No, a garment that has four square corners must have the fringes attached to it.
So, in other words, if you have a blanket, do you then put...
According to this, you have to put on the tzitzis. That's correct. That's correct. That's correct. That's correct. If you use it during the day, yeah.
If you use it, so is it
kind of embarrassing.